Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to today's Football Times from These Football Times, a podcast return after a little while in the wilderness. We are back with a slightly adjusted format as well for these pods, so hopefully that'll all go well. It's totally unplanned and off script, so who knows what's going to happen here. I've got a couple of pals with me as usual, though, to chew the fat on all things football. So let's introduce them without further ado. So Paul McParlan is with me. How are you doing there, Paul?
Yeah, fine. It's great to have the podcast up and running again, and even more so because I think last time I was involved in one of these, I was looking forward to a season in the Championship, but thankfully that's been avoided.
Well, there's always next year, Paul. You never know. On the slightly more successful end of the scale on Merseyside, Stephen Scragg, who is in a red room as we speak, it looks like, on the cameras. Anyway, he's basking in the glow of Liverpool's almost comeback yesterday.
Very, very nearly. Yeah, not so bad, Aidan, not so bad. Yeah, we're mid-table Liverpool at the minute, more pertinently. But yeah, no, we'll get there. But yeah, I'll find my end. Looking forward to kicking the podcast off again, and a little bit of change as well. You know, it's today's Football Times, but with a slight difference. Rather than once a month, it's once a week. So this is. A familiar step in a different direction.
Yes, this is the plan, once a week. That's the aim anyway. We'll hopefully get there. Just chatting through things that have happened this weekend or in recent days in the football world and a little bit of look ahead to what's coming as well. So, well, Paul, why don't you kick us off then and lead us into a first subject and we'll see where we go.
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing that kind of struck me, I'm a big fan of non-league football as well as being a fan of Everton. I'm a season ticket holder at Marine as well, my local team. And one thing that's kind of struck me since post-COVID is the way there seems to be a real kind of a increase in attendances in non-league in several clubs, even at levels down below the National League as well. So, for example, in the pre-COVID, Marine were averaging about 420, 430. Last season, the average 1,022. Now, I know there's a bit of a boost from the cup running against Tottenham, but even so, that crowd has almost gone up by 60%. And the crowd has stayed. You know, it would have been easy for people to come, not like the experience, and drift off. But people have stayed, and that's made a massive difference to the club's outlook and the club's finances. But it's not just Marine. You look at Dorking, who've just got promoted to the National League. Three seasons ago, they were averaging 699. They're getting 2,000 for their games in the National League now. I'll take Banbury United, who are also in the National League North. They were averaging about 460, 470 three seasons ago, and their gate's now up to 1,100. And there just seems to be a general trend and maybe a bit of a revival of interest in non-league football generally. Your part of the world, Aidan, South Shields are getting over 2,000 fans in for a game at Step 3, which is incredible support. And given the frustrations they've had of missing out on promotion in the past couple of seasons, how that support stayed with them is massively impressive as well. And if you kind of go up to the National League, and I know it's kind of an unofficial kind of League 3 these days, but some of the attendances there are absolutely staggering. They're on a par with some Championship clubs and with some League One clubs. So I know Wrexham have had the Hollywood effect, but even so, their gates have gone up from 4,000 three seasons ago to over nearly 10,000 now. Chesterfield, when they were in the league, were averaging 3,630. They're now averaging 7,000. Oldham, when they were in the league, were also averaging just under 4,000. They're averaging 7,500 now. And I think the interesting point about that is, certainly for my generation when you're growing up, if you dropped out the league, you dropped off the map. The attendances fell, the ground fell into disrepair, and you just weren't getting talked about anymore. But there seems to be a real turnaround with that, dropping out the league is not the it's not the banishment into limbo that it once was, that there's a very healthy future in a very competitive league with Gator holding up extremely well. And I mean, I don't know how true this is, but I can only speak from my own experience here at Marine. But one thing I've noticed here is, A, the increase in the younger supporters under the age of 18, which has been really encouraging. B, the increase in families, because, you know, compared to watching Everton and Liverpool, if you've got two kids under the age of 11 and you take them to the match, all three of you can get them for less than £10. Now, in days of economic kind of stringency, that's something that some families are going to have to consider more and more. And one thing I've really liked as well, if I walk around my local area, Crosby now, if I did this 5 years ago, I would not have seen any young kids wearing Marine paraphernalia. I see it more and more now. I just think that's a really, really encouraging trend that, you know, for maybe families, youngsters who've been priced out the Premier League or can't even get tickets for a Premier League game, there's an outlet for them there. I think another big factor is as well, the consistency of the 3 o'clock kickoff on a Saturday. I know at 3 o'clock on Saturday, there'll be a game on down the road if I decide to go at the last minute. I don't need to check the Sky schedule to see what time on a Monday morning it's been moved to so Malaysia can watch it. So it's been really, really good from that point of view as well, I think. And I just think, people sometimes can be a bit snobby about the quality of football in non-league, and I fully understand that, but most of these players have been released by the academies. They're good players, they're skillful players who just haven't quite made it. And one final point, which I think might attract people more, if I go to a Premier League game now, it's getting more and more like an NFL game in terms of the timing. What was once a 90-minute fixture is now 2 hours, or the injuries, stoppage time, head injuries, concussion protocols, etc. If I go to a non-league game, if it's more than 3 minutes stoppage time, that's really unusual. And it's such a pleasure to see players not rolling around in agony every time they're touched by an opposition player. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, the quality of the Premier League is far superior. The atmosphere is far superior. But if you're looking for an introduction to football and you can't afford to go and watch the Premier League team nearest to you, go and watch your Uncle Long Lee team, because you'll get the bug, you'll enjoy watching the game, and you'll feel, you know, totally rewarded for having devoted your time going to watch them.
Do you reckon there's other factors as well, like disillusion with the top game, top tier? You know, you're talking there about the quality, and obviously that's different. We can all appreciate that. But, you know, obviously in recent decades, I guess, there's things like the FC United startup when people got the hump with the Glazers and went off in other directions. There's other examples of things like that. I mean, potentially it's some of that. I'm thinking you mentioned there South Shields, and that's I guess not quite of the money bags of Salford, but you know they're well funded for a club of that level. But it's a huge captive audience, that area. South Shields is a decent sized town, but it's kind of split between Newcastle and Sunderland and its general support. It's stationed between the two, roughly. It's slightly closer to Sunderland, I guess. But, you know, the loyalties are split. I guess South Shields would be seen as everyone's second club in that town, kind of a unifying force. But equally, you kind of think whether disillusionment in recent years with the big clubs, how they're run, or just the top tier of the game, or the top few tiers, getting in that Sunderland are not top tier, obviously, with how things are at those. I wonder whether that feeds into it. And, you know, you talk there about people wearing Marine shirts around the town, which is brilliant to hear. Although you do wonder, though, that they're also likely to be the Liverpool or Everton fans. So you kind of think it's a second club, but one that's more accessible, perhaps, in some kind of way.
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point. I think, you know, that for a lot of people in Marine are their second club. But I think for the youngsters coming through, there's more and more of a feeling that, you know, it's Marine first, Everton, Liverpool seconds. And, you know, that's a trend that I could never have predicted. And I suppose, you know, I'm a senior ticket holder for Everton and Marine, so I look at them from both aspects. As you rightly say, you can't compete with the Premier League in terms of skill, atmosphere, etc. But what non-league does really well, I think, is that, you know, because I'm a football fan, I'm not allowed to drink when I'm watching the game. If I was non-league football, I can happily have a pint. I can stand behind the goal with my pint. And guess what? I don't turn into a raving lunatic. I don't go jumping onto the pitch to attack players. Like most people there, I'll have a quiet, relaxing pint, watching the game. And it just adds to the whole enjoyment of the spectacle. So I think that's a factor as well that, you know, and also that one of the big things I think the Premier League hasn't quite, might need to look at again is, I don't understand what reasons why it's, you know, it's segregation of football fans. I think the segregation increases hostility. I mean, at the non-league game, there's no segregation in most fixtures. And, you know, people mix. You'll talk to opposition fans in the bar before the game, at the end of the game, and there's very rarely any issues there. So, yeah, I'm sure that's a factor as well. And, you know, I just think now, you know, with families really being having to look at the budgets, you do kind of wonder whether, you know, the cost of Premier League football for someone who's got a season ticket is going to be more and more of in their thinking in terms of whether they go to watch games or not. And when, you know, when you've got the alternative of a local non-league club on your doorstep where you can have a pint, you can meet the players after the game, and you can do all this for about a tenner, for some people that might become more of an attractive option.
What do you reckon, Steve?
I think Paul's got a lot of valid points there. I mean, I know plenty of supporters of bigger teams that go watching non-league games, you know, to the point that it's, you know, it's become the routine. You know, they go and watch a non-league game, and the club that they've, you know, grown up supporting still remains in the heart, but it's almost like they've become a television programme rather than, you know, a live action, you know, entity. You know, there's a famous banner out there that says, you know, football is not a television program. Well, you know, I think for a lot of people higher up the ladder, it has become that way. I mean, you know, you look at my perspective of Liverpool. Yes, I'm a season ticket holder. I go to watch them, but, you know, that's only 55,000 of us that do that. You know, across a very, very, very large fan base, only a small amount of, you know, small percentage of Liverpool supporters actually click through the turnstiles to watch them. You know, they should be able to, you know, those who don't, you know, yeah, get out there and go and watch games. I mean, I've done it. You know, I go watching non-league games whenever, you know, the chance arises. If I've a blank Saturday and there's a fixture on, I'll go and, you know, click through a turnstile somewhere. You know, it's, as Paul said, it's, you know, it's quite liberating. You know, the differences are as good as the similarities. So, you know, yeah, and I think with non-league football as well, you know, the exposure for it's a lot higher now than it ever has been before. You know, BT do a great job of showing National League games, you know, FA Cup games will be on the television, you know, featuring non-league teams, I think a little bit more than it was kind of like 10 years ago. I know it's not a brand new thing, and, you know, this was something that was happening, you know, 20 odd years ago. But I think there was a time when television companies were reluctant to show the non-league games, but now they seem happy to do so, which is great to see. And then, you know, you look at something like Wrexham and what's going on there, and yes, as Paul said, there's the Hollywood factor to it, but within that, it draws a lot of interest. You know, I've been watching Welcome to Wrexham on Disney Plus. And it's been a fantastic programme. You know, I was sceptical over it, tuned in for the first couple of episodes, thought, good God, this is brilliantly put together documentary that, you know, is very much kind of like, you know, honest with its approach and know where they've come from and why they're doing it. You know, and it's quite absorbing. You know, and Wrexham have always been a club for me. I've always refer to them as being within the Liverpool Echo footprint. You know, you get the Liverpool Echo on a Monday night, and then you would look at what Liverpool had done, and Paul would obviously look at what Everton had done. But then you'd scan through all the little kind of like, you know, match reports of all the teams that were within the catchment area as such. And Wrexham to the south and into Wales were as like the furthest. I think we went Bangor City occasionally. So, you know, they've always been on my radar of Wrexham. And yeah, you know, it's still absolutely brilliant to see what's happening to them. But yeah, then you get to see behind the scenes as well in this documentary that's going on. And now I just think the exposure, and what exposure there is, it's done very, very well. you know, BT's Saturday night games are, you know, an antidote to whatever Sky is showing in the Premier League. And as well, it's the fact that there's so many league clubs that have fallen by the wayside. That National League must be populated by pushing two-thirds former league teams now. You know, you've got some league teams who have slipped further down into the regionalised, you know, sixth tier, basically. You know, and it is. It's, you know, such a... And then on the opposite side of that scale, you've heard of football clubs kind of complaining about, you know, the coverage that they get when they go into League Two. You know, so they might, you know, if they're at the top end of the National League on the way to promotion, you know, they might have been broadcast kind of like 10 times across the stretch of the season. And there'll be no live games once they get into the League Two, or very rare that they've got live games. So, you know, yeah, it is. It's, you know, it's a great environment for football. And yeah, I do. I think, you know, it's riding the crest of a wave, basically.
Speaking of League Two there, Stephen, I think, obviously, they used to be, well, a long time ago, it was elections for the bottom four. And then if you're lucky, you might get lifted up out of non-league if you had the right friends in the right places. Then it went to one up and down, and then it's gone to two. In my mind, it should be three or four. If it's a 24-team league in League Two, I think to ease that flow, just to give people a bit more aspiration, or make it a bit easier to actually escape. Right? It's a trap once you've fallen into it, non-league, it seems, for some of these clubs. You're talking there of your regional news programs. We go as far as York City, which I find slightly odd. But anyway, York City, you know, they've slipped way, way down. For a reasonably sizable-ish city, it's bizarre that they're that low. But you kind of get stuck there, don't you? And there's so many of these teams that have got stuck because it's such a limited opportunity, a limited scope to get back out. I think it should be at least three, if not four, automatic, because it's a 24-team league. You need a bit of turnover.
I agree. I mean, you've got four teams go down from League One to League Two, and then you've only got two going down from League Two to the National League. You know, Wrexham going back.
It should be four between the Championship to League One.
Yeah, it should be. You know, it is basically the fifth division. You know, and it should, you know, the relegation and promotion from, you know, fifth tier to fourth tier should mirror what it is between third and fourth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly right. And as both you said, Stephen Aidan, that National League now, they're not strong ex-league teams. Like, you've got Notts County, the oldest football league team, who've been there for three seasons now, who've not been able to get out. You know, Wrexham have been in that at that level for 10 years. You've got Chesterfield in their second season now. You've got Halifax in there, being there for a number of seasons. So there are some really, really strong, well-supported teams. And I agree with the two of you. I mean, why there's only two promotion places from the National League, you know, it seems ludicrous to me. At the very least, it should be three. But, you know, there's a really, really strong argument for, you know, four promotion places to be allocated to the National League. And, you know, what they bring to the League Two is more quality as well, and a bigger fan base. So financially, it kind of makes sense for the Football League to agree to that.
Anyway, let's move on, shall we? Stephen, let's go to your subject next.
I've changed this afternoon from the advertising.
No, this is hot take stuff.
Yeah, this is. It's kind of like Wolves sacking Bruno Lage. You get why, but at the same time, you know, the last league game they played before this weekend, which is the game that's, you know, being the straw that's broke the camel's back, you know, was against the Manchester City side, who've just at six past Manchester United. You know, the timing always seems to be the questionable thing in these instances. You know, that's a game they've lost yesterday against West Ham, against a team that haven't started all that well themselves. A bit of a hangover from last season. You know, they were in with a shout of Champions League football for two-thirds of the season, then drifted out of a lost a Europa League semi-final. And I think they've licked the wounds a little bit, West Ham, this season. But if that result yesterday had gone the opposite way and it was a Wolves win against West Ham, are we turning around saying David Moyes is due to be sacked? You know, it's that perpetual merry-go-round, you know, that kicks in, and this time of year is just absolutely fatal for it. You know, it's absolutely shocking. But yeah, I found that a little bit left field. And yeah, they've slipped into the bottom three. But we're talking about teams here who've played very little football over the last month. You know, my team themselves, it was, well, I think it's been that was just their second league game yesterday since the end of August. You know, you've got to get some kind of momentum, or at least some kind of thread of results that go against you before you jettison a manager. I just found it utterly peculiar. I got it, you know, yeah. On one side I got it, on the other side it just makes no real common sense. When a manager's been able to spend a bit of money in the summer there as well, and I just think, you know, this isn't you know, the usual season. This is a very, very different season. So the parameters of where clubs are hitting the ejection button, I think, needed to be a further month down the line. You know, if you get into the World Cup final starting in mid-November and you're in the bottom three, then I get a team getting twitchy and panicky and then saying, right, we're off. But yeah, this one just, yeah, seemed a bit out there.
We may have another one by tomorrow night if the East Midlands derby doesn't quite go in Leicester's favour.
Indeed, indeed. And if we do, we'll have to get Charlie Carmichael on next week to talk us through.
Our hot take might be less hot if that's happened, and we're talking like it's still in the future. And it does seem to be earlier and earlier, doesn't it, when the pressure comes out. There's always the odd one or two where the axe swings down slightly earlier, doesn't it? But we've had that already with, you know, Scott Parker basically saying, sack me, I've had enough. In not quite as many words, but he may as well have done. But it does seem a bit like, yes, okay, you've dropped into the bottom three, therefore we must make a change. It's almost that simple, isn't it, in people's minds. Wolves, a club who've been in the top half in recent times, you know, seemingly like a well-run club. I don't know how true that is, but it seems that way looking in. It is bizarre. It is twitchy, but you know, it's an increasing trend, sadly, I think. I mean, you do need... I get the flip side. People talk about longevity in terms of managers as though that's what brings you success. People say, oh, well, look at Alex Ferguson, look at Wenger and all the success they got by staying around for a long, long time. So, well, they stayed around because they were successful. You know, it doesn't necessarily follow. You have a bad manager and you keep him for a long time, you'll still be bad. So I do get that side of it. But yeah, it is increasingly twitchy. But I guess that's the modern way. What do you reckon, Paul?
Yeah.
As a club who's changed manager several times in recent years.
Yeah, I think sometimes, well, I think going back to Everton's situation, which we discussed in detail, you know, in a podcast last season, you know, when you appoint a manager who's unpopular with the fan base before he's even stepped foot in the ground, you always ask them for trouble, aren't you? But going back to Wolves, yeah, I mean, Stephen makes some excellent point there. I mean, I think we all kind of felt Bruno Lage was going to go pretty soon, but I didn't quite anticipate it being this weekend. And you kind of look at Wolves' record this season. I mean, they only conceded 9 goals. I mean, that's a really strong defensive unit. And they're quite lucky that the star signer is a Sasha Kalajdzic, if I pronounced that correctly, who they brought in from Germany, got injured in his first game. And so they were left then with the transfer window having closed and not being able to bring in a replacement striker. So they were quite unlucky there as well. I do wonder whether... Now, when you're bringing in Diego Costa as your striking solution for a guy who's not played for, like, since January with Neil, I don't think he's renowned for his team spirit or, you know, his goodwill to fellow men. You just kind of think that's a bit of a, you know, whether that alarmed the board or not, I don't know. I mean, was it a gamble too far for him? I'm not quite sure. And then you kind of look right, well, one would assume, probably erroneously, that if you sack the manager, you've got a replacement lined up. Now, if they have, I was trying to work out something. Who, you know, apart from Big Sam, who else is floating around and available, who's ready to step into a post like that? I'm really not quite sure. So, yeah, unless they've got a plan, it seems a strange decision.
The timing's odd as well, isn't it? Sorry, Paul. Timing's odd as well. When you've just had a week off, just had an international break.
Yeah.
First game back, knee-jerk reaction. Yeah. Losing at West Ham is you know,
it's not
there's nothing
worst,
wrong with that.
Yeah. No, it's not. And, I think
I've got to adjust. I think that's the thing for me. It's the timing more than anything else. Yeah. it's like on Friday, you know, on a day where they've got a game that evening, Hull City sacked their manager. It's the time, and it's not necessarily that they've made the move to do it. You know, I forget which De Boer it was who was in charge of Crystal Palace for four games. But, you know, it happens where managers get a job and they're out of it within a few weeks. You know, you look at Watford, who've sacked yet another manager and probably will, you know, dispense with Billick before the season's finished. But, yeah, the timing is always the one that kind of, like, really kind of, like, leaves big question marks.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right saying that there's a right time to sack a manager, isn't it? Yeah, and sometimes the fans can see it when the board can't. So I agree with you. I mean, to sack Lars before the recent exacerbate kind of makes a crazy sense because he's then got like 2 weeks to prepare, you know, prepare the scene, getting them ready for the restart. Sacking them just before the World Cup starts also makes perfect sense as well. I mean, when I go back to Everton last season, though, when Liverpool absolutely humiliated us 4-1 the derby at Goodison, that was the time to get rid of Benitez. That was the perfect time to do so, rather than panicking at the end of January and leaving the new manager Lampard little time to bring signings in. And going back to the game on Monday night, you know, it's from the outside looking in. You know, to me, Brendan Rodgers, you made. Not agree with this, Stephen. Seems quite a capable manager. You know, he's got a decent track record. He's won trophies. He's done well as a team that, apart from that one title success, hasn't really made a major impact on the football map. I don't think so. I think, you know, for Leicester to be challenging for European spots, you know, to them, I would have thought would be success. But I've been reading some of the Leicester threads, you know, and they're blaming Rodgers for being in average players on big, long contracts, not being able to motivate the players. So maybe when you're there, there's a different perception from it when you're looking at the situation from the outside. Because to me, you know, I would have every faith in Brendan Rodgers being able to keep that team up. But, you know, once the home support starts to lose that faith, you're in quite a difficult situation. And then you've got the other crazy situation when the Notts Forest chairman, who has a reputation for not having much patience with managers, he sacked Carlos Carver at Olympiacos, I think, last week, and he's only been there about seven games. You know, he's allowed Steve Cooper to buy 22 players. So then, is he going to sack Steve Cooper so the manager comes in with 22 players who's not even brought to the club, and he's supposed to do something with that? I really don't know. And you kind of look at, if we've been having this conversation this time last season, one of the managers we'd have been talking about as being under pressure was Miguel Arteta, because at that time they lost the first three games. You know, social media. I know you can put way too much store by social media, but there was definitely a feeling that his job was under pressure. And it's good to see that this season, the club have been rewarded for showing a degree of loyalty and, you know, giving them a bit more time. Because I think we all agree, managers need time. But I think, as you made the point, Hayden, you know, being successful guarantees you more time, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, you don't want to give Steve Bruce more time. He won't get you anywhere. But when it comes to the likes of the guy at Forest and Scott Parker at Bournemouth as well, you kind of think it's bad for your career to get promoted in some ways. You know, you're doing a fantastic job at the higher end of the Championship, but the biggest mistake you can make sometimes seems to be getting promoted. Because then you're on a hiding to nothing. It's going to go badly. And the twitchy fingers on the trigger are too easy to pull. When really, like, what are you really expecting from these people? Even worse, when you say Steve Cooper, he's got 20-odd players coming in and the rest of them going out because there's so many loan signings or whatever. It's not really built on solid foundations. But what are people supposed to do in these situations? Scott Parker as well. Obviously, did a fantastic job last season. But it was never, you know, how much can you expect from these people? You know, success isn't going to suddenly come along. You're not going to find it that easy, no matter what you do. And yet, it seems bizarre that they end up under pressure for a string of bad results. Where really, what else do you expect? So yeah, key message there. If you're doing well in the Championship, is don't do too well and stay there.
It's kind of the English way, though, isn't it? You know, a player or a manager will get a team or multiple teams promoted from one division to the next, and then struggle in the one above. You know, if that's Italy, you know, the scene is a Serie B specialist. And a coach will get a team promoted to Serie A and then depart the club because they, you know, that newly promoted club will say, right, we now need to be equipped for a completely different division. So we now need someone who is an expert at, you know, guiding the team through this division. So and I think the coaches themselves kind of like get it. You know, there are Serie B specialists who just move from club to club to club, and, you know, either win promotion or threaten to win promotion with them repetitively. You know, and they don't seem to kind of like blink about winning promotion and then being jettisoned for someone else once that team gets to Serie A. It's like they know what their strength is. You know, Scott Parker is you know, pretty exceptional at getting teams promoted to the Premier League. Maybe the Premier League's not his thing. You know, who else was it? No, Farker at Norwich was a similar, you know, build. You know, was exceptional at getting Norwich promoted to the Premier League. Absolutely shocking at trying to keep them there. It's just an English way of thinking. It's this concept that, you know, there's almost like a false loyalty. You've got us promoted now. What we'll do, we'll give you half a dozen games to see if you're worth keeping hold of in that higher division. Now, you only have to look at kind of like the way that they do it in several other nations, in how a team will qualify for a major international tournament, be it a European Championship or a World Cup. They'll often have certain players who are part of the qualifying campaign, yet they don't get to go to the finals. Now, that to us, you know, from an English looking perspective, that seems epically harsh. These are the players that got them there, yet they're not allowed to have the big moments in the spotlight in the finals. Yeah, but what they do is they split the two completely different missions. One has a mission to get them there. You know, it's like the Netherlands. The Netherlands always used to have a coach that would win them a place in the World Cup finals, and it wouldn't be them that go to the finals themselves. And we'd look at that and say, that's epically harsh. How cruel is that? Yet from their perspective, that's just the way they did it, you know, an accepted norm.
It's like the football equivalent of the baseball starting pitcher and the closing pitcher, isn't it? You know, one's there to get you part of the way and the other's one there to finish it all off. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it?
Going back to what Stephen said there, I mean, you know, you can't think, if Neil Warnock could be an Italian, he'd have been loaded as a Serie B specialist, wouldn't it? Because that was what he was good at. And you're right, yeah. Stephen, you know, maybe there should be more recognition that, you know, managers have certain levels, and that at a certain level, they're a good manager to bring in. Yeah, I'm struggling with Steve Bruce fits into that scheme.
Well, we give him his due. He did do quite well at various clubs in the Championship level, so maybe that's where he should have stayed and not come up with the Premier League. I fear we're heading into saying things like Aladici soon as well. I don't know what the Warnock equivalent would be. Anyway, well, speaking of Italy, though, I'm gonna transport us over there for my topic for the moment. So, a combination, England and Italy. Prompted by seeing Chris Smalling score Roma's winner at the weekend, it's thinking about the English players who are sort of thriving over there. You know, he's one who's doing well, kind of rebuilding his career, I guess, to some extent, having sort of dropped down the pecking order from being a Man United and England regular-ish. But then you look at Tammy Abraham and how he, a sensational season last year, at Roma, and ended up helping them to a trophy as well, a Conference League. And Fukayo Tomori, another excellent young player, thriving over there. It's such a great opportunity for these kind of players, I think, to develop and grow. Now, I'm not saying that the spotlight isn't on them, because, you know, Italy is, if anything, more intense than here, but they're sort of, They come as the foreigner to the situation rather than the local boys or the people who've had the pressure coming through that they might have in this country. So to some extent, I wonder whether they're slightly out of the glare that they would have done. I know it's a different glare. It's still a glare, but it's slightly different. And maybe that's helped them thrive. It's a new environment, new styles that they're learning or learning to repel. New approaches to things. It's just enhancing their education in ways that, you know, having come through an English system, they'll have been developed in all sorts of ways over here and learned all sorts of styles, but they're getting exposed to something completely new. You could throw in, I guess, Germany as well, slightly into the mix in terms of Jude Bellingham currently obviously is thriving at Dortmund. Jadon Sancho was before him, and you see how he's gone off a cliff slightly since moving to England. It's not quite working the same for him. It's there's something about the different experience for young players to actually thrive a little bit more. I do like that path. I think maybe it's just I'm sort of more of an internationalist. You know, I've jacked in work and traveled several times and things like that. You know, that's just my worldview. I kind of like to get out of the little closeted environment and go and see other things and experience other things. Pitching that onto a football stage, that to me seems like something that I'm surprised more people don't want to do. I don't know whether there's a fear of the unknown, perhaps a fear of being forgotten. And I do think this is possibly the flip side of it. So I'd be interested to get your views on this. If Tammy Abraham had done what he did last year in England, I think he'd have been a shoo-in for the England squad regularly, and maybe not to replace Kane, because Kane, you know, is a very, very good striker, good forward, with more experience. But Abraham should be in there with him, I think. Now, you know, people like Calvert-Lewin, Paul, have had more England chances, I think, than Tammy Abraham. I don't think that's right, personally, because I think Abraham has achieved far more than Calvert-Lewin ever will, if I'm being honest, in terms of what he's done at a big club in Italy. I think he's possibly getting slightly forgotten. Tomori maybe falls into that bracket as well, where they go for other options when it comes to the England team that are closer to home. So maybe that is the negative flip side of it, perhaps. But I think in terms of development, I see it as such a golden opportunity to broaden your horizons in so many ways. In pure footballing terms, it's new styles, new approaches, different ideas, and that can only improve you as a player, even if you then do come back to England and bring these to bear back in the Premier League. I think there's so much to be gained from it. And yeah, seeing Chris Smalling score for Roma, I would never have thought it, having seen him a few years ago in England, that he would be someone who'd play for Roma doing well in Serie A. That just seems absolutely bizarre. He's not the kind of player you'd imagine would go to a place like that. But maybe that's just me thinking of the 1990s and how Serie A was, where you had to be, you know, a true world star to go there. Things are different now, but that opens up more opportunity for more people. And it just shows that players like that can thrive. Maybe his career would have just drifted had he stayed in England. And it's been such a positive move for him. Abraham too, he wasn't getting the opportunities in England. He's gone there and look at him, and the way he's performed there. It's absolutely astonishing. I just wish, yeah, possibly they get slightly more recognition for it. They do get slightly forgotten. I don't know what you guys think of that.
I was going to say, I think perfectly right, because the alternative for a lot of players like that is, I don't know, playing for a lower ranking Premier League team or a high flying Championship team. You know, we've had Liverpool players who've shown rich potential, been sent off on loan repetitively season after season. You know, Harry Wilson's one, where can't even tell you how many loan deals he had over the years. Went and played exceptionally well for a lot of teams across the board, and you know, was never going to really make it at Liverpool. Now, there's a player that could have gone to Italy and done very well for himself. You know, yes, it does seem strange, but this is a different Serie A to the one that, you know, we all became attuned to in the 80s and the 90s. But it doesn't make it any less valid what they're doing. You know, I think it's a huge, bold move to make. And, you know, I applaud it. I think it's an outstanding thing to do. But yeah, you know, it's that, I don't know, it's the great adventure it is to push themselves and say, look, I can play well in one of the biggest leagues in Europe for a club of stature, and that's what they're doing. You know, Serie A is riding the crest of a wave at the minute. Certainly not financially, you know, to what it was, but certainly in terms of what's happening on the pitch, it's become a fascinating league all of a sudden in the last 2 years. After that, 9 years in succession that Juventus won the title, that was in danger of killing the league off completely as an attraction. Now suddenly,
what are they now, Stephen? Like seventh or eighth or something?
Yeah, they're labouring somewhat. They're winning tonight, but you know they're not pulling up trees or anything like that. You know, you've had Inter won the season before last, and they've started terribly this season. They've won, you know, 8 games. They've won 4 and lost 4. You know, the Milan won the title last season. They got a late winner last night. Napoli have started the season really well. Lazio looked fantastic this afternoon. I watched Lazio's game this afternoon. They looked fantastic. You know, I think what you're looking at the minute is Serie A is a very open league where there is a danger, or, you know, a welcome danger that the champions might not come from Milan or Turin, which would be absolutely outstanding for the league. And for players, domestic British players, to be involved in that, I think it's the right league at the right time. It's never going to be the Serie A of old, but, you know, this is a Serie A, you know, a new Serie A in a way. And it's becoming, you know, really attractive. It's in danger of becoming the hipster's paradise. in a new way, though. Not in the way of old, in a new way.
Yeah, I agree with everything Stephen said there. I think, you know, particularly Tammy Abraham, as you said there, Stephen, he wouldn't have been a regular starter for Chelsea this season, I don't think. So then, you know, what's his preparation? He's sitting on the bench. You know,
you'd have been looking at him playing for like a Bournemouth or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
We had it with like Rian Brewster, who had a lot of people saying he was, you know, how good he was and how good he was going to be. You know, had a loan spell at Swansea. You know, he was signed by Sheffield United, who was struggling in the Premier League, and he struggled to do it in the Premier League for Sheffield United. You know, and he's that kind of like level of player that you could suggest Tammy Abraham comes from. And Abraham's, instead of kind of like falling into that pattern of signing for, you know, and it's not meant to slag them off, but a team like Bournemouth, who've come back into the Premier League after a couple of years away, or a Fulham that constantly yo-yo between the top two divisions, you know, that would be the easy move to make. But you know, they've taken a big step and said, no, what we'll do, we'll do this slightly differently. Chris Smalling, I think that's a fantastic story of Chris Smalling as well. You know, I think any player that's played central defence for Manchester United across the last decade has been on the hide into nothing. You know, it's you know, you might make some big bucks, but your CV is going to, or your track record, your rep is going to take a hammering. You know, you've only got to look at Maguire at the minute, and just how much he's been torn apart by football watchers everywhere. You know, and he's thought, no, he's gone off, and I don't know, he's looked really impressive in a team that's, you know, I don't know, because they've underachieved somewhat as a collective, really, especially with Mourinho in charge, and they've not been able to qualify for the Champions League last season, but they've won the Conference League, and you know, there's a stepping stone. And suddenly, you know, that victory yesterday against Inter will put a spring in their step, and there you've got some, you know, some British players there involved in that, and they're going to be fascinating to watch in the coming weeks and months.
Oh, definitely. I think I going back to Tammy Abrams as well. There, you know. A footballer's life is short, isn't it? You know, and you have your peak years as a footballer. So, you know, if you've got the right mindset, you don't be spending those peak years sitting on the bench waiting for the cameo appearance or being loaned out to a club you've got no commitment to. So I'm really, you know, quite impressed with the way, you know, Abe has gone to Italy. He's guaranteed a regular start there, and he's justified that, you know, the faith in his manager. I think as well, I mean, I think, you know, Premier League squads tend to be very bloated as well, so there's more competition for places, maybe less so in Serie A these days, given the financial restrictions they have compared to Premier League clubs. Also, think as well, you mentioned a really good point about the profile, and like, if you kind of cast your mind back to the 90s when football Italian was on Channel 4, you know, for me, Italian football was the thing of the 90s. It was far, far superior, more fascinating to watch than the English equivalent here. And, you know, with the advent of Sky, Premier League, BT coverage, etc., you know, Italian football's in many people's kind of radars has kind of, you know, fallen off us a little bit, and it doesn't quite have the same profile. Even like when you pick up the papers on a Monday and you read through all the reports, I've used the Times as an example. You've got a 16-page sub in the game, 15 pages of that is about the English game, and then you get about half a column about a game about the Italian league, Spanish league, and German league. And I'm kind of thinking, well, as a football fan, I'd actually like to read more about these other leagues. You know, I could do without the sort of two-page special on Bournemouth's defensive inadequacies. I'd rather be reading about, you know, what's going on in Serie A. I mean, you know, the decline of Juventus, that's a fascinating story. You know, I'd like to find out a bit more about that. So I think the profile issue maybe comes in people's minds as well. And yeah, I mean, I don't know, our wages are factor, you know, I mean, if you're not that motivation, you're getting paid a considerable amount of money for, you know, just sitting on the bench, knowing that you're on a 4 or 5 year contract. Well, you know, I think we've all worked with people who've been quite happy to be in that situation in the various jobs we held over the years. So maybe there's that as well. But yeah, I think I admire any player who makes the decision to go abroad, adapt themselves into the culture, adapt themselves to a different way of playing, adapt themselves to learn a new language. And you know, football, being a footballer isn't all about just being what you do on the pitch. It's about what you bring to the pitch from your experience outside the game, from your understanding of the culture you're living in. And develop. I think if you develop as a person, you develop as a footballer as well.
It's an attitude thing, I think, as well, Paul. You talked there about people happy to either sit on the bench or, you know, go on loan to some nondescript lower league club or wherever it is. It's a mindset, an attitude of, okay, I'm not going to be in the Chelsea first team. I could just sit around and coin in my wages, or I could try and better myself as a player by seeking new adventures somewhere and getting as far in the game as I can. At the end of the day, what is it they're in the game for? For some people, maybe it is just money. Maybe it is. And that says volumes about their attitude. It is a job at the end of the day. I don't want to totally belittle it. It is a job. But, you know, there's another side to football, and that's about glory. It's about development, being the best you can be. Well, that kind of thing applies to any job, I guess. But, you know, not everybody has that drive to do that. And it's a certain attitude that will take a setback, not getting the opportunity, not getting a regular place, being constantly farmed out. We'll take that kind of setback and think, right, well, what can I do to change this, to change the narrative, to change the story, and to improve themselves? So, yeah, I think that kind of thing's to be admired. Talk there about culture. I remember Jonathan Woodgate as well when he went to Madrid. You know, he had a year, I guess, which probably helped, a year being injured before he actually got to play in that spectacular debut that everyone remembers so well. But he had a year there before that. But he sort of went out and about and visited various things and learned the language and things like that. And that kind of attitude about life in general, you know, it's not just about football, as you say, it's about life in general, being open to things. That develops you as a person, which can only help you settle in these places as well, and only help you when it comes to playing in those teams and develop yourself as a player. I guess not everyone thinks the same, but it is good to see these guys flourishing over there. But if we move on a little bit onto what's coming ahead, I'll crack on, because I'll stick on a European theme here. We mentioned the Conference League there. I'm going to big up both the Conference League and the Europa League coming up this week. I'm sure Stephen might have something to say about a bigger competition as well in a moment. But looking through the fixtures coming up later this week, so on Thursday, the Europa League and the Conference League playing, just looking at some of them, it kind of just harks back to a bygone era a little bit, but it's in a good way. So you've got Roma against Real Betis. We've got Sturm Graz against Lazio, or Red Star Belgrade against Ferencváros. These sound like games that were in the sort of early knockout rounds of old European competitions, where you had big teams from all sorts of nations spread across the continent facing off against each other. You know, you've also got Hearts, Fiorentina in the Conference League, Anderlecht, West Ham. Now, in days gone by, that would have been a cracking UEFA Cup tie going into the last 16 or something like that. Cologne against Partizan Belgrade, Basel against Slovan Bratislava, things like this. You know, it's evocative of a different time, I think. It makes you wistfully reminisce about European competitions in the good old days. It does for me anyway. You know, exotic pairings, a little bit of the unknown, a little bit adventurous. I think, to me, the reason it kind of stood out, I could have picked any week of fixtures for these competitions to have made this point, I think. But to me, it's everything that Champions League has taken away for the top teams. So it'll be really interesting to see what Stephen thinks of this. I think that competition, for all its undoubted quality, it seems like it's on an endless repetition, you know, a broken record that's stuck repeating itself over and over, endless loop, for all its quality. And you know, don't get me wrong, the quarterfinals onwards, I think the Champions League are uncomparable in any competition in terms of the quality, and at that stage, the entertainment, I think it is absolutely magnificent. Anything prior to that, absolute dross, not interested in the slightest. But it's the same things getting regurgitated over and over. It's lost something in that, I think. And I wonder, for the teams involved or the fans of the teams involved, does it feel a little bit the same? Because it's just, it's the same opponents, it's the same games, and it's quite predictable. I think these other competitions still have that to some extent, and they should be celebrated for it. Someone should also write a book about that kind of topic, Stephen. You know, the European competitions of days past.
Yeah, someone needs to write a trilogy about the old tournaments.
But what do you think, Steve? What is it from a Liverpool perspective?
No, I agree with a lot of that. You know, I watch Liverpool's input into the Champions League, but I don't watch anyone else's games. You know. We'll be playing on Tuesday night this week against Rangers, and I'll look at the Wednesday night fixtures, and I doubt I'll find a game that I want to watch. What I'll do, I'll end up putting the Rolling Goals roundup with James Richardson and everyone on it. I'll watch that instead. I do, you know, the group games in the Champions League are awful, you know, and it is, you know, that familiarity of drawing the same teams again. This is like the third time in about 5 years, 6 years we've played Napoli. It does become repetitively dull. You know, that familiarity does breed contempt. Not these again. You know, it's you know, it can be really, really, really kind of like off-putting.
I see Florentino Perez wants to play you more often, doesn't he? He's been saying today.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. I've had a couple of good results in the last 2 years. But yeah, honestly, it's not. And you're right with the fixtures that are coming up on Thursday night. You know, Ferencváros, Red Star Belgrade is, you know, two teams that have a huge relevance to Liverpool support of a certain age. You know, they're the two teams that are largely credited with the way that Liverpool altered how they played from central defence, rather than having the stopper central defenders, to having ball playing central defenders and playing in a more continental style of, you know, bring the ball out with your feet and, you know, you're not just hitting a ball into the channels and playing the percentages.
Feels so, like a Cup Winners' Cup semi-final to me, that one. That's what it feels like.
It does, yeah, it does. It has got Cup Winners' Cup semi-final feel to that. You know, West Ham and Leicester, you know, that's a repeat of the 76 Cup Winners' Cup final, you know, automatically, as soon as you said it, Rob Rentenbrink and Van der Elst have sprung to mind. It's the antidote to kind of like that repetition of the Champions League group stages. Different, as you say, different matter when the knockout stages kick in. But even then, you know, you're still seeing a lot of repeat games over and over again. You know, oh, these two are playing each other again. It is good that, you know, this antidote. I'm more likely to watch a game on Thursday night than I am on Wednesday night.
I would love to be in your situation, Dean, having the familiarity of being in the Champions League every season. I'm sure it must be so tedious for you having to put up with that level of times every week. but you know, I accept the general point. I mean, like you, sometimes, you know, I'll try to pick out a match to grasp my interest. And having grown up, you know, on European football, but that you've covered brilliantly, you've covered brilliantly in your three books. You know, games like, you know, West Ham against Anderlecht, like Ferencváros playing, their fixtures are really interesting, because I like to see what these teams like now, because I've got this glorious image of them as to how they were in their European heyday, and I'd, you know, like to compare that now. And even things like, you know, the Hearts Fiorentina game. I mean, that's a fascinating game for me, because, you wonder, you know, the standard of the Scottish League, you know, it's been good this year that, you know, because of Rangers' success in the Europa League, Scotland then got two places in the Champions League. And so Scottish football has benefited by that. So it's good to see Scottish teams, you know, competing in Europe. It'd be great if Hearts managed to get to the knockout stage. And I think, I mean, for me, the big thing with, UEFA doesn't get many decisions right, but the idea of that, if you win the Europa League, you qualify for the Champions League, I thought was a really good way forward. And, you know, you get a team like Eintracht Frankfurt, who wouldn't have qualified by the normal process in the Bundesliga, but qualified for the Champions League because of their success in the Europa League. And Sevilla made a habit of that for 4 to 5 seasons as well. So that's quite a good route. I do wonder, I mean, I don't know what you think, Steve, but when we move to this kind of Swiss League format, is that going to involve more of a shake-up of the type of fixtures that clubs have? So is it going to be just regurgitating the same old group fixtures, you know, Juve against Real Madrid, AC Milan against Barcelona? Or is it going to be, will it have more of an element of surprise to it in terms of the fixtures that may come about? And does that make it a better competition to watch? Or is it just really a prototype for the European Super League?
Prototype for the European Super League, I've no doubt about it. You know, it's, you know, as much as UEFA, you know, wrung their hands about the projected European Super League, that wasn't anything to do with any kind of abhorrence to the concept of it. It was just that it wasn't going to be under their control. This is what they've wanted for years. You know, we're going back to the late 1980s when they started to make these plans for what is the Champions League now, and, you know, mention of European Super Leagues, you know, can be charted way, way back to the 1930s. You know, this is just a path that will lead to it, and this will be, you know, the first big step towards a potentially UEFA embossed European Super League. You know, I fully expect to see something that was, that is akin to what was proposed, but it'll just be under UEFA, you know, sanction, under UEFA, you know, the UEFA banner, you know, unless, you know, the clubs get their heads together and go for it again and just say, look, we're not going to put up with or we're not going to take on the protests, you know, which again wouldn't surprise in the slightest. I don't see a broadening of the competition. I see a continue of the monopoly as is, but maybe with just the seats rearranged. Obviously, you know, you get a Newcastle, you know, that's like an off like Newcastle such, but you know, the lottery winning club that can buy themselves a place at the table, like Manchester City have. You know, PSG did have a little bit of a European history about them, you know, before getting the Qatari books. But, you know, there will be people who can always buy a place at the table, but it's either going to have to be, you know, the existing, you know, legendary clubs that are big hitters now, or buying yourself a place at the table. You're not going to get the smaller clubs, you know, muscling the way into that cartel.
Yeah, I saw the thing this week, you know, change of sports here slightly, but, you know, the proposals for the new rugby league whereby certain prestige clubs would be guaranteed not to be involved in a relegation struggle. And you're just thinking, you know, are certain people in football looking at that model and thinking, you know, that might be worth, we might be interested in that.
Well, I mean, this was part of one of the Champions League proposals, wasn't it? That you'd qualify based on history, which, you know, to those of us who... Yeah. Have grown up with football and the ways it works, it just seems absolutely ludicrous. But that's the kind of thought people are having now. And you do wonder if there's going to be more like that. It's a sad, sad times if it goes that way, I think.
Well, I mean the big worry for me at the moment is, and it's gone off the topic slightly, is that, you know, I think at the moment there's about eight Premier League clubs have American owners or with the major shareholder is American. And you kind of look at, you know, the Premier League rules that you need 14 clubs to be in agreement about changes to the league system. And I'm just starting to have these little anxious fears that, you know, it's only going to take another 3, 4, 5 clubs to be taken over by an American investor. And you could well end up in the situation 3 years down the line where the Premier League meetings, you've got 14 American owners who, A, want a European Super League, B, don't want the in-community relegation, in a position where they can make substantial changes to the game. And that's a real concern for me at the moment.
What else are we looking ahead to then? Stephen, what have you got for us?
You know, Liverpool are playing Rangers. And I think it's less so the fact that, you know, this game is taking place on Tuesday, or the game that does take place on Tuesday. I think it's just that it brings that kind of evocative feel for kind of like the England-Scotland clashes of the past. You know, it's always going to bring to light that type of thing. You know, we've had our clashes against Celtic before over the years. I've been to Parkhead and watched a UEFA Cup game between Liverpool and Celtic, and they do have a majesty of their own. you know, I wrote about the Celtic Leeds games of the 1970 European Cup semi-final. And, you know, I just think they've got a particular vibe about them. And yeah, I'm looking forward to it on the basis of the past rather than the present.
There's been some great British ties. The Liverpool Celtic one a few years ago, it was cracking performance. Was it McManaman who was
that goal?
Celtic Park was magnificent, wasn't it? But then you hark back to Rangers against Leeds. Was it 1992? I'm thinking in my mind.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah,
it was was that the first Champions League, so called, where it was the second semi final group stages it ended up in, wasn't it?
Yeah,
but they were fantastic games. It was such a big event, wasn't it? Right. It was broadcast live when not that much was as well, which was helpful. I think it became a big event that everybody was able to join in and take sides on and watch, wasn't it?
But what they had was that sense of occasion, which is something that's lost to football now because of the dilution of it. And I think not just that, but I think it's down to a big part of that is the detachment of players from, you know, the great unwashed. You know, there wasn't that huge chasm in kind of like, you know, when players were earning significantly less. They were still earning very good money, but they weren't earning the type of money that would have them set for life by the age of 18, 19. You know, these were players where it was kind of like you'd watch a cup final and you would be able to get that sense of occasion and what it meant to the players. You know, you knew what it meant to you as a fan, but you know, you got that sense that this is massive for the players. Whereas nowadays, I don't think there's a single game on the face of the planet that seems to have that sense of occasion. Whether that's a Champions League final or a World Cup final, you see players walk into a stadium off a coach with the headphones on, and it could look like any other match. That's, you know, it could be the opening game of the season against the newly promoted team that you're going to put five goals past. You know, and I think those European games, and like you say, that those Rangers Leeds games were absolutely huge at the time. You know, and I just don't think you quite have that now. You know, I certainly don't feel that. But yeah, I think the fact that it's Rangers this Tuesday, it's just it's brought that little kind of, I don't know, that aura back to what it was. But again, it's nothing to do with Tuesday night. And Tuesday night is just going to be a very formulaic event. I'm sure of it, but not in the stands. The stands, you know, the fans are going to really kind of like go for it. But you know, I just think it's just not got that majesty.
Well, it's not going to capture the nation, is it? In the way that Leeds Rangers tie did.
It's not.
Nobody else is going to be that bothered. You know, we'll sure look out for the results and so on. But nobody's if you're not invested interest.
Yeah, it might have been different to Steven Gerrard still being the Rangers manager. Now, the concept of Steven Gerrard bringing Rangers to Anfield for a Champions League night, that might have been something a bit different.
Still wouldn't have reached those levels, though. You're right, that would have brought extra interest to it, and there'd have been more press attention on top of what there already will be because of that. But I still don't think that would capture the neutrals in the same way.
No, it's that dilution now. You know, you've got it all on a remote control or at the click of a mouse. You know, you can watch absolutely anything you want at any time of day in any league. You know, we've said it before, there are no surprises anymore. But you know, a lot of the magic has rubbed off football across the board. But yeah, you know, I just. It's one of these things that it's a fixture that, I don't know, it just brings pangs of kind of like what we've lost rather than what we've still got.
You can tell we're all of a certain age, can't you? Paul, have you got something else that we're looking forward to? How about some positivity about the future?
Yeah, well, I mean, kind of going back to long league theme again here. It was the third qualifying round of the FA Cup at the weekend. So it was the draw on Monday for the fourth qualifying round, which means teams are one game away from the first round, you know, with possible live TV coverage and facing a league club, etc. I know, just scanning through some of the teams who'll be in the hat for that draw. You got Clitheroe who are the division below Marine at the moment in that draw. You got the reformed Bury AFC. Now, I mean, that is a real story there. The fans who kept the club going, the playing of Ackliffe Butler's ground, but they kept the club alive. So that's quite fascinating to see. Your local teammate, South Shields, were in the fourth qualifying round. Now, you think, you know, if you get into the first round, you know, a game against Hartlepool, I don't know, I mean, a bit of a northeast feel about it, you know. You've got a team I'm not too familiar with called Ansley Nomads. Now, just for that name alone, I'd love to see them in the first round of the FA Cup. You know, and there's a lot of talk about the FA Cup, you know, it's lost its romance. And I agree, from the third round onwards, it has. And you know, a team from the big four or five is going to win the FA Cup, no matter what happens in the previous rounds, which has kind of been the way now for 20 years or so. But the early stage of the FA Cup, everything is still possible. And I just love it when these teams, you know, have their moments in the limelight. I know, I mentioned that Tottenham FA Cup game changed Marine's profile incredibly. And you know, for the next team to benefit from that, that's going to change their profile incredibly as well. I'm sure it helps Salford City in terms of their building their momentum for Football League stasis, all the coverage they're getting the BBC. FC United have got loads of TV coverage as well a few seasons prior to that. So one team will come through into that first round who no one's expecting, who've not been covered before. And it'll be a big moments in time for them. So, yeah, I just think that's really fascinating to look forward to. And you just really hope that, you know, that one of them somehow, you know, let's go back to South Shields again. And let's say they get in the next two rounds, they play non-league teams and they come through third round of the FA Cup, the drawn away to Newcastle United. I mean, these are the things that you live for, aren't they? You know, and these are the things that keep supporters going. And also the type of thing that revive a competition. And what's been good about the FA Cup qualifying process this year is, as we came out of COVID, these replays were scrapped at this level. The replays are back now. And that just makes a real difference to us. So you've got a team like Hanley Town who go and draw with Chester in the third qualifying. Now, they were to Chester and get a 0-0 draw, and they bring them back to Hanley for the replay. Now, logic dictates Chester will walk the replay, but what if they don't? You know, what if Hanley win that game and then get to the first round, and with Hanley being in the potteries, they draw Port Vale in the first round of the FA Cup? So there's all sorts of possibilities. So I just really like this time of year when you're looking at all these teams making progress in the competition, and you just know one lucky draw and the fortune of the club can just be changed immeasurably in all sorts of different ways.
We'll all look forward to South Shields against Ansty Nomads then. Eh?
It'll be all ticket, you won't get in.
you're totally right. Say the romance is not dead. There we go. Hot take there. It's true. The qualifying rounds, it's the unusual, the sort of mystique, the odd pairings and things like that. That's where it's fantastic. And what I've always found endlessly frustrating for some of these teams when they reach the first round proper is they get drawn against another non-league club. That must just really, really annoy them, having got that far. Or even worse, if you make it to the third round and two of them get paired up. That's happened, hasn't it? And must be devastating for them. Anyway, any more before we wrap up? And we probably should wrap up soon. I think we need to give a shout about Indonesia. We need to mention that.
Yeah, we do. That was terrible. Terrible to wake up to today. You know, just no one, you know, goes to a football match should be, you know, waving the loved ones off never to see them again. You know, it's always going to strike a resonance with me anyway. Just shockingly, you know, sad news. And as ever with stuff like that, you know, be careful what you listen to and what you take on board. You know, do your own. Yeah, do your own, you know, investigation, make your own minds up. You know, official takes on things can be, you know, let's just say off target in those initial 48 to 72 hours.
Well, there speaks the voice of experience.
Yeah, me certainly agree. I think we said in this podcast quite often, no fan should go to a game and not come home alive. It's just absolutely against everything we stand for. I know. And coming on top of, you know, the stadium disaster in the African Cup of Nations as well, it's not been, and combined, you know, with what Stephen experienced in Paris, it's not been a kind of a good year for, you know, for events that have been organised by major soccer confederations. So yeah, obviously you can do this, you go with the families involved, because that type of thing should never happen. And what you don't want is the same old excuses being churned out as officials try to deflect the blame, somewhere else and refuse to take responsibility for what happens.
Yeah, it seems to be sort of, I don't know, misplaced fear of whatever the crowd may or may not do, and therefore go in all guns, not literally, all guns blazing, in this case, tear gas blazing. But yeah, I mean, Stephen's absolutely right to not just trust whatever source the first one happens to be, or seeing things on Twitter or the likes, is making sure we're well informed about what actually happened, because yes, things may come to light later in the day than the first stories, as Stephen well knows from bitter experience. What else we've got coming up? We've got more pods coming up as well. Andy Gray, Paul, finally. A chat we had with the the Everton legend, Wolves, Villa, Scotland, Sky, everything else.
Glasgow Rangers.
He reminded me on that one.
As he reminded us, yeah.
Knuckles wrapped early on in that chat. But hey, fully deserved. He was quite right.
Oh, yeah, I mean, if anyone who's listening to this pod now, when the Andy Gray pod is released, you really just have to listen to it, because the guy, we could have recorded another five pods within the year. He went into so much. He's an actual raconteur, but he's just got so much background and insight into his life as a footballer, A, at the top level, and then B, as a broadcaster, because you kind of forget he took a massive gamble taking on that role with Sky at a time when Sky was struggling to get customers. So he's a player who is known to the younger generation for his work with Sky, but also to the older generation for his career, for his time as a fantastic footballer, no matter who you support. So it's a fascinating conversation from start to finish. I think me and Aidan, we've asked some really, fascinating questions there, and he's gone into huge detail in his response. Nothing was off limits. There was no aging beforehand saying you can't ask him about this, you can't ask him about that, And he had a difficult situation at home with his wife being a bit unwell, but he still found the time to speak to us. And the guy just lives and breathes football, so it really is. It's better than watching TikTok. It's time well spent, honestly.
And his take on what went wrong at Aston Villa is worth it alone. Yeah. Yeah, fantastic stuff. Really, really good. Okay, any more before we wrap up then?
One brief thing, Aidan. Just quick word for Barrow, who are actually challenging for promotion this season after the three relegation struggles after getting back in the Football League. And they're in the top six, so well done to all involved in that.
Well done, Barrow, indeed. Okay, well, we'll wrap it up there. Cheers, Paul. Cheers, Stephen. Thanks for... finally, we're back on the pod again. It feels good, doesn't it? It feels good. So thanks for both your contributions.
Yeah, it's like riding a bike. No, we've not done this for what seems like an age, but yeah, I think five minutes in, it was like, it just felt like 48 hours ago.
It's like one of those bands, isn't it, Stephen? They're at the peak in the season and they're reforming again. They're back out. They got the original members back. So, hey, you might have missed us, but we're back, guys.
And just like buses, there'll be none for ages. Now we're going to bombard you with plenty of podcasts. So hopefully there'll be lots coming. All right, then we'll close things off. Thanks, everyone, for listening as well. Do join us again. Like we say, there'll be plenty more from the Lob podcast with These Football Times. So join us again another time. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.